Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thank you so much for doing this with me today. I loved the series. Just absolutely
loved. Thank you, man.
And I think that your pairing with Mark, it's just so good. There's so much I want to get into, but I actually have a few other questions I want to start with, because you're known, the subject matter you tackle is, it can be heavy, it can be deep and serious. And I want to sort of maybe throw a little, I want to try to get you to laugh a little bit, or
you got it.
throw out some, do a little bit of other stuff. So do you remember your first movie or TV show crush?
My first movie or TV show crush. I mean, dude, it had to be the $6 million man or Lou Ferrigno, the Hulk, man. I mean, but then I also remember Daisy Duke. I couldn't really watch it. And then of course, Bo Derek. When I was a kid, I could not. I remember watching like 10 would come on TV, and I'd be watching TV with my parents, and just the fact that her last name was Derek, I couldn't move. I was frozen under the Afghan blanket on my parents' couch, just so embarrassed, mortified that she was running down the beach in slow motion. And there was something about slow motion when I was a kid, like $6 million man running in slow motion, and that sound, that na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, that was, and her on the beach, those are formative memories on the screen for me.
The other thing is, of course, the other things you were watching as a kid, nothing had slow motion like that.
Exactly. I think it's step printing slow motion, a lot of that. I don't think that's in-camera slow motion. I think that's a lot of that is like Phil Solomon, to bring up one of our film school references. Rest in peace, Phil Solomon.
Yeah, 100% with that. I was really shocked to hear that he had passed on.
Yes.
Is there a TV series that you would love to guest write and direct? Or an episode? Yeah, like one episode of a TV series.
One episode of a TV series that I'd like to guest write and direct. I mean, I'd have to go back to my childhood again. It would be Miami Vice, That would be it. I don't know about anything that's happening now. Everything's in such control now. And, I never thought about making TV in a way that I would come on and just do one piece and leave. That's why this whole series to me was, I wrote and directed every episode, and it was an extension of the films I had been making and unified voice. But I can see, there's so many great TV shows that have multiple voices adding to them. I just don't necessarily know how I would do that. But I'd say Miami Vice. I'd like to come on in that, take the reins from Michael Mann, see if I can't be his disciple.
What movie do you think you've seen the most?
Creepshow, George Romero.
Really? Yeah.
That was the first movie when I was maybe seven. My brother turned nine, and on his ninth birthday, my parents rented a VCR. You know, this is before we owned our own VCR, and they brought a VCR home for his slumber party, and they had two movies. They had Creepshow and Airplane 2. And we sat down with all my brother's friends, and I was just a little kid in the back, and we watched those movies. And I was scared out of my mind, and I was blown away that I was watching a movie at home. So 2 months later, at my seventh, eighth birthday, I rented a VCR, had all my friends over for a slumber party, rented Creepshow and Airplane 2. About 4 months later, April comes around, my family bought a top loader VCR. And we got a subscription to HBO. And what was on? Creepshow and Airplane 2. And so I put in a tape on the slowest mode, the six hour mode of the tape, and recorded those two movies. And literally my fourth grade year, when I was in fourth grade, I watched Creepshow every day after school. I brought a different friend home every day after school, and at 3:30 in the afternoon, watched Creepshow, put in the tape, watch Creepshow, until I had, you know, it's 30 kids in my class. So after 30 days, I was all alone, and I was just addicted to that movie. You know, my fourth grade year, just watched it repeatedly.
Have you ever thought about doing like a horror movie?
Oh yeah. I mean, in fact, in I Know This Much Is True, I got to exercise a little bit of, in episode 4, I got to exercise some of this horror movie obsession that I have inside of me. A lot of my work deals with fear. You know, I'm as a writer, I'm confronting a lot of the things that scare me, psychologically, emotionally, in terms of like guilt of like, what could happen in a situation. You know, and this feeling of responsibility. And so, you know, as a family member. So I put all of that into my movies, and I'm making movies about people, but I have this gene inside of me that goes towards horror movies. And that as a kid and as a young adolescent, it was horror movies. I mean, the second movie I've probably seen more than anything is Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn. And you know, those movies, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, all of the other, you know, Romero films, Toby Hooper movies, you know, and then the Dario Argento films, I just watched on just repeat. And then I discovered Scorsese and that changed when I was like 15, 16, I think Goodfellas came out, and that then all of a sudden became my Bible. And from that moment forward, I pinned a picture of Scorsese above my bed, and used to literally, you know, worship Scorsese my whole rest of my adolescence. And that kind of filmmaking, Scorsese opened the door to everyone else for me, to, you know, to Cassavetes, Charles Burnett, just so many other filmmakers that then I became obsessed with. But I still have that horror movie, and I do have one that I'm writing. You know, we'll see if I have the courage to make it.
I was going to say, it would be very interesting to take your filmmaking style and bring it and have the horror movie sort of in your space rather mm-hmm. than you going to the horror movie space. If you know what yeah. I mean?
Well, it is. I mean, you said in episode 4 of I Know This Much Is True, there's this moment where he gets out of his hospital bed, and it's, I mean, that whole episode to me is a bit of a horror movie. But yeah, the thing with horror movies is I always thought that they were aesthetically, you could do anything in them, right? The playbook was wide open for a filmmaker making a horror movie. I mean, look what Dario Argento could do. Look what Sam Raimi does in Evil 2. I mean, that's one of the extreme cinematic experiences still I've ever seen. You know, Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn is only a movie. There's no other translation. There's no book you could read that would give you that same experience. It is hyper highly cinematic. And so that's what I think that was one of the things that I loved about horror movies. And all of my films that I made as like a teenager and a high school student were always horror movies. You know, the very first movie I ever made was called The Bat Movie, and it was about a rubber bat that attacks people. And so
it's so interesting because in another reality, your filmmaking path is so different.
It is. It is.
You know?
It is. Talking about Phil Solomon, I had a movie that I wanted to do, a vampire movie in film school, and I brought Phil the idea, and it was going to be a vampire movie called Suck. And I told it to him, I went to his office hours, and he basically told me if I made that, I would embarrass myself and I would embarrass the school, and that as a filmmaker and as an artist, I had to get more serious about my ideas. And we sat down and I went to his office every day and learned from Phil. He taught me how to tap into what this kind of the surface of the story that I was trying to tell was all about. And so I renamed that movie Raw Footage, and it was about capturing this traumatic moment on a home video camera, and this kid who captures this tragic moment of his family, like the Zapruder film or something, that affects his who he is as a young man growing up. You know, Phil helped me tap into that. So I think it's Phil Solomon's responsibility. He steered me away from my horror roots.
Yeah, I'm thinking all about that. I think that a lot of people, I think, maybe don't know what film school. I think a lot of people nowadays think that they can do, and some people can make movies without going to film school, and others go to film school. I think maybe that's one of the examples of what you get out of a film school is a mentor, you know, shaping you when you're not 100% where to go.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, every artists, you know, need mentors. There's apprentices in every field. You're going to be a, you know, car mechanic. You need to learn from someone. There's always a wizard. I mean, Luke Skywalker had Yoda. You know, we all need someone, if we're lucky enough, to guide us. For some people, that's our parents. You know, that's you know, another figure in our life. And I think that's, yeah, it's crucial. I mean, Phil was definitely a father to me of cinema. We made totally different movies. I mean, he made experimental avant-garde films that dealt with memory, and I think I was really influenced by that. Phil, I talked to our mutual friend Jim Helton quite often, who, you know, has, you know, I met in film school, has been editing my work for 20 something years now. And you know, we all talk about Phil is like our Jiminy Cricket. He's our conscience. He's on our shoulder. And even though Phil has passed away, Phil still talks to me. He's like Wrath of Khan. He's wormed himself, himself inside my brain in a beautiful way. And, anyway, if anyone has not seen Phil's movies, I think they're out there on Vimeo or something, but he's made some beautiful films.
100%. I remember watching I could go on another thing. Okay, so jumping into why I actually get to talk to you today, this is a project that other filmmakers have been trying to tackle since like the 90s. I think Jonathan Demme was looking at it. Who else? Jim Sheridan. A few people were looking at it. And I don't think this material could actually work as a 2-hour film and be as effective. Do you think that the you having 6 episodes to tell this story is really what was able to crack this material?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you just look at the size of the book, I mean, when I first met with Mark back in 2015, he had actually, Wally Lamb had been, you know, who had written the book, had been involved in, you know, as this author involved in Hollywood and all these adaptations trying to get it made for all these years. And Gina Prince Blythewood was involved too at one point, and she's such a great filmmaker. And they could have all done really interesting things, but I think that just the challenge that they probably faced was just scale. You know, it's just too much. How do you take that 1,000 pages and boil it down to to its essence, you're going to just lose so much. And so when Wally, you know, after 18 years or something of trying to get it made, the rights eventually reverted back to Wally. And, you know, I think he was probably at a moment of that we all get to in this business of like, oh, you know, our dreams of making something into a movie are never going to work out. And his agent said, well, let's start over. Who would you, in your perfect imagination, who would you see as these characters, as Dominic and Thomas? And Wally said, Mark Ruffalo. And his agent said, well, let me reach out to Mark. So she reached out to Mark, and Mark said, oh, I'd love to read it. So he read Wally's book in a weekend. And I guess he called Wally and said, I'm going to get this made. And so then he's like, I got to find a writer and director to make it. So his first call was to me, and I met with him, and you know, we just talked about the scale of this thing, and we were like, you can't make this into a movie. And I know from doing adaptations before, you know, how hard it is to boil something down, to curate a book into a piece of cinema. I also know from my movies like Place Beyond the Pines about my own personal ambition and how I always want to tell bigger and bigger stories, right? And on Place Beyond the Pines, for instance, I had written that movie, I had written an intermission in that movie. You know, there's the moment where you get Ryan Gosling's story, then you get Bradley Cooper's story, and then there was supposed to be a title card that said intermission. And you were going to be able to take a break, go to the bathroom, get soda, whatever you did, and you come back, and then you watch the third part with the kids. But that wasn't realistic in the marketplace. And I'm not, you know, I don't have the cachet of Quentin Tarantino to be able to release a movie with an intermission, you know, right now. So so I had to change that intermission title to 15 years later. And I had to truncate that movie to be able to fit inside 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I love the cinema, as I know you do. And I love going to the movies. It's like going to church, you know, it's a very, very, it's a sacred place. But unless you have a franchisable universe, it's hard to tell a more expansive story. I think movies now are like a perfect place to tell a story like Moonlight or something, right? Or like Brokeback Mountain, you know, or Blue Valentine. You know, those are movies that were like, you know, look at Brokeback Mountain was a 27-page short story that expanded perfectly into a feature-length film because you could expand from it. So Mark and I immediately talked about, like, we don't have enough runway. We don't have enough canvas in a movie theater to do this. So let's, you know, I'd been thinking a lot of years about doing something long form for television. And I love the idea of being able to live with characters for longer. And, you know, because I always felt like the characters in my movies were like my friends. And I felt like for audience members too, they would be their friends. And so the idea of making this series where you got to know somebody, a person, people, but mostly this character Dominic, and got to really know him as intimately as you could know like your best friend or a family member, and that he would enter your home every Sunday night for an hour and you'd get to spend time with him, that he could actually be a living, breathing, tangible human being in people's lives. And you know, that's what the movies always meant so much to me. The characters in movies always felt like I knew them. You know, it could be Travis Bickle, or it could be, it could be anyone that I felt like, oh, that's someone that I understand. And it's like a real person that actually lives in the world. And so for this, over the course of 6 weeks, I thought I could create a real living, breathing human being. And you know, I love actors and performance so much, and I felt like this could be a perfect medium for me to explore character and performance. And there could be moments that I could fit inside a TV series that I wouldn't necessarily have the capability to do in a movie. You know, for instance, at the end of episode 2, there's like there's a 20-minute scene. I think it turned out to be like 16 minutes in the actual show, but a 16-minute scene inside this therapist's office. Now, that was a 20-page scene on the script. there's no way I could ever devote in one of my movies at least a 20-page scene to a movie, because that's like 1/6 of the whole real estate that's available. But over 6 hours, you can deal with that dynamic. And so I was just thrilled by this opportunity to deal with, to be in spaces for longer periods of time, to be with characters for longer periods of time, and that maybe we could actually go on a life's journey with them. And at the end of the, and I know it's, you know, I know that the series can be relentless and extreme at sometimes, but one thing that's happened in the last couple of weeks after episode 6 came out is there is such a release in the show. You know, there is such a catharsis that this character goes through, that Dominic goes through. There's actual a glimmer of a change that this guy starts to have, and it's really, to me, it feels honest and earned. And I mean, I have to tell you, I had so many people from my life from high school, that, because I'm not on any social media, but there's people I haven't talked to in 28 years that reached out to me that said that they watched the show every week and that it changed their life. And that, you know, I was so touched by that, because, you know, I didn't know about releasing a show during the middle of a pandemic, what it would do, and the responsibility of, like, everyone's isolated at home and here we are with something heavy and people want it. You know, I knew that the journey would lead somewhere, but just the response I had from people that, from my life, that came out of the woodwork, that felt like it changed them was kind of overwhelming to me. So that was kind of what it was all about to me. It was just, yeah, putting some real people in real moments and a real life on screen, really. Real life.
Completely. I ended up watching the whole series recently, all very close together, because I didn't want to watch it every week. I wanted to watch it all, because I heard you created this as essentially a 6-something-hour movie. And I was like, well, I want to watch this as close as I can together. Did you have a preference about people watching it every week or waiting to watch it all?
I thought it was interesting what happened when people watched it every week. To use a food analogy, I thought of it as like if you go to a diner and not many people are going to order an entire blueberry pie. When you order some pie, you get a slice. And if that slice is good enough, you're going to come back to that diner next week and get another slice. You know, it can be a lot to just sit down with a whole pie. I mean, it can be gluttony. So I was interested in this idea, and I tried to shape every episode when I was writing it as its own, every episode has its own identity. Every episode is about different things. Every episode has its own arc to it. There is also, I believe it can work in one fail, binging of the whole show. But what was your response to it? I mean, I think it can work either way. Like, let me just say, one of the big inspirations for this was also Bergman's Fanny and Alexander, which I never, which was made for TV, which I never saw on TV because I wasn't in Sweden in 1980 or whenever it came out. But I saw it at the Film Forum a couple years ago, and the way the Film Forum released it in their revival of it was they showed part 1 and 2 in one day, and then, you know, some other parts on another day. And so I got to watch it in pieces, and I thought I really enjoyed like coming back to it. It's also something about dealing with literature and film are two different formats, but there's something that a novel has, right? It has moments of reflection, right? You can put down a book and go to bed and consider it and wake up in the morning and then pick it up again and start again. You know, there's this idea of the chapters which allow you to reflect. And the most successful example I can think of in movies of chapters being used well is Lars von Trier Breaking the Waves, where he has those inner titles. Those chapter breaks, which allow you to digest what you've seen and to reflect upon what you've seen and to prepare yourself for the new stuff. So I thought this idea of chapter breaks was a good thing, but I'd be interested from you. So you saw it, you watched it all in one fell swoop.
That's the thing. I didn't. I just didn't want to watch it. I'll just tell you what I did. And this is, I try not to put myself in interviews like this, but I watched the first two episodes back to back. And then I did the next day, episode three, short break, episode four. And then the next day, episode five, the day after, episode six. So I didn't watch them all back to back, but I watched them all very close together. But that's how I knew I wanted to do it. I think that the material is very heavy to sit down for 6.5 hours and do it all. Although I could do it. That's just the way I did it.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like it works. I mean, look, there's no right way or wrong way to do it. That seems like it reflects my experience with Bergman, which also can be, heavy viewing. But I do think when you're dealing with heavy stuff, sometimes those moments of reflection are, can be important. But I've heard from friends now that have watched it, that binged it. And I think it was intense. The problem with binging something that's so intense is sometimes you can become oversaturated, with some feelings. And I think there's no way, I don't know anyone who would ever sit down and read the 1,000-page book all in one sitting. It can be a lot to take in. So I think space is good. And I think it's one of the, I was excited to sign this deal with HBO too, because they were just, on one hand, just so great to work with, but I also really love the programming model. I love how, I don't want to say the old school approach, but I love how things are unveiled week after week. I don't know, it brings me back to a nostalgic place of my childhood of not being able to wait for that next Knight Rider episode to come out.
Sure. Listen, I love HBO. I think what you're saying, though, and something I've noticed is I like going to museums. And I have found that I can't spend 8 hours at a museum because I just lose sight of the brilliance in front of me. I'm just saturated too much with the paintings and the everything. So for me, a few hours and then I need a palate cleaner. And then I, or palate cleanse, whatever. That's just for me,
Yeah, totally. You go to one wing, you go visit the Renaissance wing or something, and then you take a break, take a time out, come back later.
Completely. I love that HBO does it every week because there's something to binging, but I do like the ability to talk about it throughout the week. But look, I got a ton of fucking questions, so let's jump into some other stuff, which is in the writing process. When did you realize you wanted it to be 6 episodes? Was there ever talk of 4 or 8, or was it sort of like write it and then let's see where we're at and we'll figure out the episode count?
We pitched them 13 episodes, but that was my very broad strokes. That was almost my adaptation of the book, chapter for chapter in the book. That was my early breakdown of what, if we were filming the book, would be. And HBO came back and they said, can you do it in 6? And I said, let me think. And so I took about 6 months to think about how I could do it in 6. And they told me, they said, look, we love the book, but we want this to be yours. And I had a meeting with Wally, and I talked to him, Wally Lamb, and I talked to him about it. And he said, Derek, I love your movies. I trust you. He was like, the book is the book. It'll always be the book. Make this yours. And so I got permission from HBO and I got permission from Wally to make it my own thing. So I spent that 6 months imagining what a 6-hour version of this would look like. And, and it was kind of, and I didn't quite make 6 hours. I got 6 hours and 20 minutes.
Sure, exactly.
Because that last episode is a little long, but I thought it needed to be longer because the resolution, I didn't want the resolution to be cheap. You know, I didn't want the resolution to just be a nice bow that tied itself together. I wanted to really have time to experience this kind of glimmer of hope. And you know, if you look at Wally's book and his ending of the book and my ending of the show, they're different. You know, there's a lot of resolution in the last chapter of Wally's book, and I felt like it was going to be too much resolution, too much of a bow. That in a book it would work because you'd spent these months reading this book, or however fast or slow you can read, but and it would be fulfilling at the end of the book. But when you're watching a linear movie happening in real time, there's too much resolution. You know, Dominic becomes like a gazillionaire because he's related to Ralph Drinkwater, and he gets all this, you know, money from the casino, and he ends up adopting Joy's baby because she died and had HIV, and him and Dessa get back together for sure, and then he turns his grandfather's house into a battered women's shelter. There was so many things that were happening at the end that I thought I looked to my favorite movies and thought about resolution in my favorite movies. And I looked at films like Five Easy Pieces, which has to me one of the greatest endings, or a very similar film in tone, Manchester by the Sea, which ends on a glimmer, right? A suggestion of change, a suggestion of where a movie can lead to. And I had, you know, ended Place Beyond the Pines and Blue Valentine in a similar way, where it's an open ending. It allows the audience to still be a part of the story when the credits roll, and that the audience can kind of project their own, you know, at the end of I Know This Much Is True, we're not sure if Dominic and Dessa get back together. And I love the fact that the audience can project their own hope into that relationship and their own dreams. And it just reminds me of what happens at the end of, you know, those movies that I love so much. I look at the end of The Thing. If you want to go back to horror movies, John Carpenter's The Thing. They're just going to stay there until the fire burns out. And you can know what's probably going to happen to those two guys and what's going to happen to the world when springtime comes and the rescue parties come back, and probably that disease is going to travel to the rest of the world. But none of that's in the movie. We, as an audience, we make up that in our imagination. So I think the audience's imagination in cinema and in television is a very, very valuable tool and asset. And as an audience member, before I was ever a filmmaker, I try to always remember what the experience is of being an audience is like, and what I love about being an audience.
Completely. I think that's one of the reasons why the series works so well for me, is that you're not, that it isn't Hollywoodizing, if you will, Dominic. And he's all of a sudden having these dramatic revelations. You know, he obviously has gone through a lot, and he's not going to have, like, you know, an instant change to anything, you know?
Yeah.
He's, you know what I mean, but I want people to watch who have not. But I'm very curious. Yeah. So you release something at 6 hours, 20 minutes. How long did you have, like, a much longer first cut of all these episodes, or was it very tight to what you actually released?
Yeah, it was pretty tight. You know, I mean, the cuts would range anywhere from 1 hour and 20 minutes to 1 hour and 5 minutes. Our first cuts of every episode. Just like my first scripts for every episode were around that same, you know, they were, you know, always 70 pages, you know, 65 to 80 pages, something like that. You know, and then I would, you know, I was able to condense or curate the scripts. And then in the editing, we were able, you know, we edited this thing. I was shocked that we got it done, honestly, Steve, because as you know, with Jim and Ron Patain, who I work with all the time and, you know, editing, we're slow. Some people would say slow, other people would say thorough. But I shoot a lot of footage, and on this, I shot 2 per 35 millimeter film stock, and we shot 600 hours. And wow. One of the things that Jim and Ron and I, our motto on set was let's keep Kodak in business. when we crossed 1 million feet, the crew, the whole camera crew, I left set that day. And I don't know if you've ever gotten a pie in the face, but I got 7 pies in the face from the camera crew. And it hurts to get a pie in the face. And I couldn't tell if it was love or aggression, but I was bleeding. Because those aluminum pie tins, they actually can cut you. Anyway, so I was bleeding through the cream. Anyway, so we shot a lot of film. And one of my disciplines in the editing room, and Jim and Ron and I have always done this, is watch everything, because we believe in gold and the discovery of gold as we're editing. And so we did. We watched, I wrapped shooting after 115 days of shooting in October, and we had told, HBO had wanted us to deliver and have it this on air in April. And I sat down with the editing team, and we brought on some new editors. We brought on Malcolm Jameson and Nico Lewin, and we had a great VFX post team led by Eric Pascarelli. And we were all in a home, in this old Victorian home in Ditmas in Brooklyn. And I finished production. I got in with all the editors and I said, I don't think it's realistic that we're going to make our deadline, but we have to try. So we have 4 weeks to get done with episode 1 and 2. They had been working and going through everything. I was like, let's see what it looks like. If it's no good, we're not going to release it. If it doesn't work, if we're not there yet, we're not going to release it. Somehow, miraculously, I don't know how it happened. And I think it was because we were so clear, even with those 600 hours, that the cream or the gold rose to the top, that we made these decisions that were just, we didn't second guess, we didn't get too precious with it. We just moved forward and made decisions and trusted the script and trusted the performances that we got. And when we sat down and watched it, we thought to ourselves, wow, let's see what other people think of this. And so we sent it to HBO and to the producers. And I remember my producer, Greg Feinberg, was like, holy shit, we might make it. And I was like, yeah, let's keep trying. Who knows? There was still, as massive as this, as the project is in 6.5 hours, there's like 1,000 visual effects shots in the show, which people don't really notice because we all, we tried to make ourselves invisible. I think as a storyteller, for me, the most, I told you about my love for performance. For me, performance, is the main way that the story is told. It's just like in Blue Valentine, the story is told through actors. The feelings are expressed through performers. I really do believe that people watch movies to watch actors and performances. And so as a creative force behind that, as the coach, I tried to make everyone else, all my other, play all my other coaches, the editors, the cinematography, the visual effects, the production design, I tried to have them all be invisible and serve the performance and let the performance be the thing that shined through. And so with that, with that kind of methodology, it just worked. But there was a lot of, I still don't know how we did it. Just everyone got on the same page. It was a beautiful, beautiful team. I feel very, very fortunate.
Well, the other thing is that, look, you want to keep HBO and everyone who financed this thing very happy, because obviously this is really tough material and they championed it. So if they want it in April, you got to find a way to get it in April.
If we weren't happy with it, if it wasn't working, I think HBO would have been the first to agree. Okay, it needs more time. And I've been involved with plenty of films, Place Beyond the Pines, the editing of Place Beyond the Pines. Traditionally as a director, you get a 10-week director cut making a movie. After 10 weeks, I hadn't even watched all the footage of Place Beyond the Pines yet. I didn't actually show my first rough cut of Place Beyond the Pines in, for 6 months. The financiers were on ice for 6 months, and they showed up to a screening of Place Beyond the Pines, and I'll never, I was a little late because I'd been working all night, and I'll never forget, I walked into the screening, and on the screening room was a slate that the well-intentioned assistant had put on that said, Place Beyond the Pines, first rough cut, total running time, 3 hours and 32 minutes. And so here was my financiers who had waited for 6 months. They had never waited that long to see a rough cut. And now my rough cut was 3 hours and 30 minutes. And I was, it had to be a 2-hour and 20-minute film. I think they were all preparing to fire me. But when they saw it, they realized what, you know, they realized the potential of it, I guess. And they stuck with me and let me finish my process. And so I think the same thing would happen with HBO. They're so artist friendly and so collaborative. They just kind of set out a goal for us. Like, can you make this, can you hit this bullseye for us? And we were just able to. And I think it just goes back to, you know, maybe Jim and Ron and I, and the addition of Malcolm and Nico, we just learned how to run the race better. Yeah, I don't know.
This explains a lot. I was wondering when I saw four names for editing, I was like, four editors. I'm like, or Derek had four editors on this. I'm like, that's a lot of editors. And I'm like, well, now that makes a little more sense.
Well, I always look at, you know, heat is always one of my main inspirations. We talked about my advice earlier, but heat was really a huge inspiration for this show. Mostly in the use of, when it came to the twinning aspect of the show, because I was really inspired by that scene in Heat where De Niro and Pacino meet up in that diner in the middle of the night. And I was always blown away by that scene because you never see their faces on screen. So you get these two titans of acting, but their faces are never share the screen. It's always shot counter shot. And I thought, like, well, it's flip sides of a coin, and you can never see both faces of a coin at the same time. And I thought to myself, well, that's how I'm going to make this movie too. It's going to be just flip sides of a coin, and I'm not going to have to resort to all the technical trickery of twinning. Eventually I adapted that and changed it. But anyway, Heat, I think there's five editors on Heat. So there's a way to edit and get a lot of rooms going and still maintain a vision. And as an editor, I'm always in the editing room too. I always have my own machine set up. And so most all the cuts come through my room at the end, and I'm able to unify everything and see every cut. And anyway.
I think a lot of people don't realize what it actually takes to put everything together. But I want to go backwards. Was there discussion about shooting digitally at all? Or were you always, this has to be film? And when you're shooting that much footage, that has to be a cost. That's not cheap to shoot that much footage.
No, it wasn't. It was a discussion. And it's always a discussion to shoot. And the assumption, more often than not these days, is that people will shoot digital. And I have a little bit of an issue with that being an assumption, because I love digital. I've shot plenty of things digitally. Blue Valentine, I shot half of that movie on a red camera. But that format was a choice. I believe in using the digital format as a tool to better tell your story or better express the story that you're telling. And I think it's a choice. Now, all these years ago, like, I heard, people would come out and declare film is dead. And that always just rubbed me so the wrong way, because film is irreplaceable. And I'm not saying it's the only format. Like I said, I love digital. But for this, you know, this story takes place in the 90s, in the 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, 10s, right? Pretty much the whole 20th century. And in none of those decades, in none of those eras, was their HD. You know, if I was to shoot on a format of those, of any of those eras, it would have to be for the 90s, some kind of SD video, some standard def video. And, you know, when I shot the 70s, it would have to be like whatever William Eggleston shot Stranded in Canton on. And what would end up happening for me is I'd have to choose different formats to illustrate the different times when film was a constant throughout all those, throughout all that time. You know, film was around for the entire 20th century. And so I thought film was a way to unify all of our time frames. I didn't want to differentiate between the time frames. I didn't want to have anything except the production design change in these time frames, because a lot of it is about history and memory and a place, you know, and you get to see, you know, this home that Dominic grew up in. You get to see his grandfather actually building that home. And so I didn't want that to be that far removed, because it was only 30 years before Dominic was born that he was building that that house. And so I wanted to unify it, and I thought that film could really unify it. And, you know, and beyond that, also as a filmmaker, I believe in the power of film creating an urgency on set. There's something with digital, depending on what camera you use, but you can shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot on digital. Whereas on film, you have a magazine, which can be a different length. Sometimes we'd shoot a 1,000-foot mag, which would give us a 22-minute load. And sometimes we'd shoot on a 400-foot mag, which would give us a 9-minute load. And depending on those, the size of those loads, it creates like a shot clock. And sure. So as a director, I think I use a lot of sports analogies. I think of myself as the coach, my players are the actors. And so if I have a 9-minute shot clock and I have my actors come into a scene, they know they got 9 minutes on the clock to get something done, to get some points done. And to me, it raises the angst on set. It's like a stick of dynamite. To me, film is like dynamite. You light the fuse and you got this much time, and you know, the fuse is almost out. It's almost out. You better get something before, oh, it's over. Okay. You know, and on digital, on Blue Valentine, when I shot digital, I was shooting like 45-minute takes. In fact, there's not as much urgency on digital. In fact, one moment Ryan Gosling actually fell asleep during a dinner scene in Blue Valentine. For real, I got footage of him falling asleep because digital can find the. I think digital can find the erosion of moments in a beautiful way. Film can find the spark. And so, you know, I brought it to HBO. There was a cost issue. HBO was a little bit on the fence about it. You know, they would have rather initially that I shot digital. And I said, well, let me just shoot a test for you. And so we shot a test. We got an Alexa and we got a Arri 2x35. And we put the cameras right next to each other and we shot the same test with both cameras, and we tried to make both cameras look the best they could, right? And we made a split screen and we made this reel to show HBO and just said, pick which one you like better. And it was unanimous, for at least for the story I was telling. I'm not saying for everything, but for the story I was telling, film was clearly undeniably the winner. I will say one thing that happened. There was one thing I realized on digital and film was I was shooting my friend Gabe Fazio, who was Mark Ruffalo's acting partner, you know, in all the twinning scenes. And I was shooting this test on film and on digital of him, and he was leaning up against a bridge. And on film, it was the shot of this guy leaning up against a bridge. And on digital, I noticed that there was an army of about 10,000 ants crawling on the architecture of the bridge and walking towards Gabe. And sometimes digital can see too much. And that's great. I realized that that could be a really interesting tool for something. But I didn't want people to watch the show and be looking at the ants. I wanted them to be in more of this painterly world.
No, completely. I've recently watched some stuff in IMAX laser projection, and I was sitting next to the director, and after the screening ended, I do a screening series in LA, and we showed something that was a number of years ago, came out 10 years ago, and he said, that's the clearest I've ever seen the movie. Like, as in, you might make different choices if you know it's going to be that clear.
Yeah, sometimes, again, when we start talking about the imagination of the audience, to see everything can strip something of its mystery, I think. It can lose a little bit of the mystery. And what I love about filmmaking is that mystery and this idea of the persistence of vision. And when you're watching a movie or a TV show shot on film, you know, you have this magical shutter. So you're seeing 24 frames a second, but you're also seeing 24 frames of black per second. Your brain chooses not to see those, right? The flicker of the shutter. But it's still, that's it activates your brain in a different way. And there's just something about 24 frames a second film, shutter degree, you know, shutter angles that does something to our subconscious. And I wanted to tap into that.
Completely. I want to touch on episode 5 specifically, if you don't mind. Can you actually? Sure.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
Oh, I just want to make sure. I want to make. Are your earbuds dying? Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's okay. I just put on the speaker. Yeah, you got me.
Yeah. Are there earbuds dying? Damn Apple.
They are. Yes.
Yeah. I want to specifically talk about episode 5 because it was. I haven't read the book, and so when that episode happened, and you go back in time. I was A, not expecting it, and B, it was so well done. But that's also, you're making something like that on a budget. So how did you pull off that transporting backwards in time to everything you did in that episode?
Yeah, that was a very important element of the story for me. As you know, in my past work, I've been dealing with this idea of legacy a lot. Familial trauma and the things that get passed on throughout the generations. You know, that's what Place Beyond the Pines was all about. And I was, you know, I have an Italian American heritage. And it seemed like every Italian American movie that I had seen dealt with like the mafia, you know, or wise guys in some way, you know, some of my favorite movies, Goodfellas, Godfather, you know, it's all mafia Italian, but growing up Italian, that wasn't true to my life. And all, you know, my wife who has Italian heritage, that wasn't true to her life. And Mark Ruffalo, who is Italian American heritage, that wasn't true to his life. We didn't grow up with gangsters. We grew up in Italian American households and we grew up with something more a more specific version of this kind of training of masculinity within that culture. And it was something that we, you know, for Mark and I, we carried with us into our adulthood. And we were really, confronting it, right? As men, this idea, this masculine upbringing, this masculine training as Italian Americans that we had. And so I was always fascinated with going back in time and kind of uncovering my own family history. And I had a great grandfather that moved over to the States from Northern Italy in the 20s. And this guy was a very dastardly character. It's only a few stories I know about him, but those stories are so dramatic that they hung over my whole upbringing. They hung over my grandfather's life. They hung over my father's life. They hung over my life. And now I have two boys of my own. And I know that that guy, that great grandfather, made these choices that are still very, very much alive in my world. And so I've always wanted to go back in time and uncover those those choices that he made and this idea of this trauma that could carry down through generations. And, you know, when you asked the question about could this ever have been a movie, that's the first thing that would have been cut from a movie version. In fact, you know, the first time I ever read this book, because I have struggles with reading. The first time I ever read the book was actually a book on tape. And the book on tape that I listened to didn't even have the Italian section in it. They cut it out. It would be the first thing that people would want to cut out. But to me, it seemed to be one of the most interesting parts of this character's kind of search for homeless in himself, is to kind of break this cycle of, you know, it's recognized as a curse in the story, but what that really is family trauma that's passed on through the generations. And so you know, so to execute that, the first thing I had to do was find actors, you know, who felt like they were from another time. And I had no idea who I was going to cast in that role. And then I saw Matteo Garrone's Dog Man with Marcello Fonti.
Sure.
And Marcello is truly from another time. He grew up in Calabria. He's one of nine children. He's from the past. You know, he's particularly modern in a lot of ways, but his face, his thoughts, he's a treasure and a relic, and I've never met anyone like him. And when I saw him on screen, I reached out to him. He happened to be in New York. I've met up with him. He doesn't speak a lick of English. And when I met him, I immediately said, that's grandpa, you know. But it's against type too, because Marcello is hilarious. He's a comedian. I mean, he's like the heir to Roberto Benigni. He's a clown. And here I was writing this character, this dastardly grandfather, this evil man who traumatized his family for generations with the choices he made. And here was this sweet guy, Marcello. And it speaks a lot to the power of him, his power as an actor to be able to deliver that performance. And then, you know, in terms of our production design, you know, and then there was all these other great actors that I found, Roberto Regano, Simone Coppo, Irina Muscara, so many great Italian Americans. You know, I went over to Rome and cast all the Italians there, and, you know, HBO brought them all to America. And it was important to me that these were people that were not Americanized, right? They weren't Italian Americans already. They were Italians, because this is about the immigrant story.
Sure.
And so they had to be first and foremost Italians. And we tried to, you know, my last film, Light Between Oceans, was a period piece. And there was one thing about the period piece that always was struggled to me, because I'm always trying to find the imperfect picture, the dirty picture, you know, like the imperfect family photo. And when you go back to research, you know, so many, you know, period photos, everything feels like a BBC drama. Not to throw shade on that, but everything feels so clean and put together. And I wanted to find the dust and the dirt and the sweat. And, you know, one of the things I talked about with my production designer and costume designer, you know, Kasia and Imbal, was that in all of our old photographs, no one had any facial hair. And I thought to myself, well, I want to make a movie about the primal human experience. And these people should be, you know, they're almost like the cavemen version of our characters later on, and the primal versions of this Italian American upbringing. And so we just tried to make it as raw and as dirty and as sweaty. I mean, in fact, we were shooting one scene when, you know, Domenico goes and gets his brides at the cousin's house.
Sure.
And we were shooting that in the middle of the summer, and we had air conditioning in there for the crew to keep everyone sane. And I was just like, there was no air conditioning in 1915. When this scene is happening, we have to kill the air conditioning.
And I was like, everyone there is like, I'm going to fucking kill Derek.
They were. They hated my guts. But everyone was, the actors were so sweaty for real and uncomfortable and raw. And as a crew, we were too. And I'm when I make things, I'm very much like, people have called me a method director. I believe in experience. And, you know, the crew, they might have been mad at me at that moment, but I think they all look back at that moment as one of the great times. Sometimes hard moments that you go through become like the greatest stories that you tell. But that was the kind of authenticity, I guess, that we were going for is, you know, let's go back in time. If we're going to be back in time, there's no air conditioning back in time. Let's live it as closely as we can. And then I was lucky enough to have actors who were just so on board with that and would settle for nothing less. Honestly, if I was to try to, you know, Marcello is so hardcore that if I would try to Hollywoodize it for him, he would have rejected me and lost all respect for me. So I had to provide him a true experience.
I'm curious, when you're writing, how are you thinking about the visual style of how you want to tell the story? How early on are you thinking? Because with this project, you worked with a lot of close-ups. There was a lot of close-ups, and mm-hmm. I loved it. But I'm just curious, when did you know that's how you wanted to tell the story using close-ups? Are you thinking about that in the writing process, or is it when you're, you know, when the script is done?
I'm addicted to close-ups, first off. All of my films are pretty much consumed with close-ups because I just feel like I can't get – when I'm in a room with actors and things are happening, I just want to be in there with them. I just want to be – you know, I read one time that John Ford said that the most interesting landscape is that of the human face. And, you know, and I try to balance my close-ups with some extreme wide shots too to just give you a sense of environment, you know, and Sergio Leone is like one of the great examples of using of this kind of visual dynamic of close to extreme wide. And I've always tried to live in that space. I'm not much of one for being in a medium shot. When I see a medium shot, I don't know. It just looks a little bit, I don't know. I don't know. I guess it feels regular to me or something. And I don't know. I part of my whole deal with performance is I want to put people under a microscope. I want to put actors under a microscope. And so when I'm writing, I watch the movie in my head every day. This was one of the disciplines I learned when I was trying to make Blue Valentine for 12 years. Right, 12 years. I write Blue Valentine in the daytime. And I think to myself, I'm going to be shooting this movie in 3 months. 3 months would come up and I wouldn't be shooting the movie. And so I started to discipline myself with just watching the movie in the screen of my mind. So every day of those 12 years making Blue Valentine, I started to watch the movie. And it just become part of the process of me making films is when I'm writing or when I'm in pre-production, I visualize the story and I try to meditate or whatever you want to say and go sit in a room and just, you know, I could be eating dinner with my family and they could be saying to me, where are you right now? And I'm just watching the movie, you know, it's happening. And I could be driving the car on the highway, 75 miles an hour and be thinking about the movie, which sounds dangerous, but that's just where my mind goes. Now, although I don't necessarily love storyboarding. Now, I storyboard some things. There's been plenty of commercials that I've storyboarded. There's sometimes action scenes that you have to storyboard and really plan out. You know, the moments when Dominic and Thomas run across the road, you know, that has to be like planned out, you know, to the millisecond, you know, what happens in those scenes. But for the most part, I try to go on set. After having visualized this thing and seeing it so clearly in my head, I try to go on set with as wide open as I possibly can and open to discovery. And I try to tell my actors to surprise me. That's what I want to, you know, I live with the script and with the movie for so long on my own. Once I get other people around me, I want them to show me their interpretation of it. You know, so I'm fascinated with actors. So one of those things that I do with the close-up is I try to put the camera away from the actors so they can have some, so they forget about the camera. I think Ryan Gosling one time said to an interviewer, he said, most movies you have to pretend that you have to pretend that it's real. And he said, on my movies, he has to always remind himself that it's just a movie. So I try to put the camera in a place where it's not going to be obtrusive with the actors, but it's just like a loving friend that's in the room observing and witnessing and experiencing with the actors. And then from that place that I find the camera, I'm just addicted to going longer on the lens and to experience this world from this kind of disembodied point of view, I guess it is. And, you know, you could talk to my DP, Jody Lee Lipes, you know, on set, he would sometimes force me into doing a wide shot. And every time he did, I was very thankful for it. But it's just the way I see the world. If, you know, if you and me were in a real room and not on a Zoom meeting right now, I would be, my eyes would be in close up on you. It's just the way I see things. It's just that, you know, I'm kind of consumed with details in people's, the things that aren't said, you know, in conversations, the moments between moments. I'm kind of obsessed with trying to be inside the soul and the psyche of a person. And I just think the close-up helps me get there.
Sure. What about, I've spoken to a bunch of filmmakers and sometimes they have, you know, obviously multiple cameras shooting a scene. And then, mm-hmm. I talked to Roger Deakins and he talks about how it's just one camera on set, no matter what movie he's making. Blade Runner, you name it. It's just one camera where he places it. Yeah. So how often are you having multiple cameras in a scene, or is it just usually one camera at all times?
You know, it depends on the scene and it depends on the project, the film that I'm making. Now there's certain, you know, I've shot, you know, for instance, Blue Valentine, the story of Michelle and Ryan falling in love was all shot with one camera, handheld, one lens, one point of view. The second part of that movie, the part of them falling out of love, was about individuals. It wasn't about this union of two people coming as one into one camera. It was about these people being separated in their space with two cameras. And so I shot that with two cameras cross coverage, and that became very informative and important. And aesthetically, it allowed me to separate them in the space. And so I did utilize a lot of two camera coverage in this show, because I was shooting so much improvisation, right? And, you know, when I hear that about Deakins, it makes sense, because Deakins feels very, very controlled, right? And one thing I'm trying to do as a filmmaker is balance control with chaos, right? And so if I have Rosie O'Donnell and Mark Ruffalo in a scene together, and they're two heavyweight champs, right? And Rosie is a really hard person to fight with, right? Because she's fought with a lot of people. She's had a lot of battles in her life, right? And she knew that character of Lisa Sheffer because she had a social worker that was very important to her in her upbringing. And she has five kids and she's just been in that place. So she knows that story and that character. And she's a comedian and she's quick on her feet. So I can go into that room, and if I have a camera on Rosie and a camera on Mark, I can get them to explode my script and to find these discoveries that could only happen one time. And if you're shooting these kind of dialogue scenes with one camera, and I've done it plenty of times in my life, you have to kind of build it again in the edit, because you try to rebuild these fleeting moments. And so if I shoot a scene with Rosie and Mark, you know, that's a 10-minute scene, and I shoot for 4 hours with them, and I had one camera, I got 4 hours on Mark, I got to go another 4 hours to get Rosie's side. And some of those little, what I call them, is like Halley's Comet moments, the moments that pass by the screen and are so rare and precious that they it takes another 80 years to get them again.
Sure.
If I have two cameras, I can catch Halley's Comet at the same time. I can catch both sides of it. I can catch, because part of what I do as a director is I really work with through actors, right? A lot of my direction, if I want something out of Mark Ruffalo, I don't always tell him what I want. Sometimes I tell Rosie what I want. So when Mark is coming into her office and demanding that Thomas sees a doctor and gets tested for HIV, and he's being really harsh with her, I sense to myself, this is imbalanced. So I'll tell Rosie, are you going to let him talk to you like that? This is your office, right? And that's all of a sudden all that Rosie needs. And then she comes back and fights and attacks him. And so I work that way with actors, but sometimes I need those two cameras to get those moments, because you can't, you know, the first time that she will unleash that her, and like the first time that she comes in and like surprises him with like, hey, wait a minute, I'm not a gal. Okay. A gal is what you call someone's horse. There's only one true reaction that I'm going to get to that. Right. The rest of it is going to be acting, right? Or performance. But Mark's reaction to Rosie saying that the first time is going to be behavior. And so what I try to capture with my camera is behavior. And so two cameras sometimes can be very, very, very helpful with that.
Mark had to put on some weight. You shot all the stuff with him thin. He has to put on weight. You coming back and filming. When you're carrying that much extra weight, I would imagine a lot of people get in a bad mood because they're not feeling as good, because you literally are putting a lot more pressure on your body. Did you notice any sort of change with Mark once you put on that weight? You know?
But it was the opposite, because here's the thing. Again, this goes to behavior. When Mark and I first talked about these characters, I said, I don't want to be embroiled in a technical movie. Right. If we're going to do this, it has to, and you're going to play twins. Let's think about it. When you're born, when these two twins are born, they look exactly the same. They're identical twins, but they have 40 years of different life experience, 40 years of choices and of consequence to their actions. So when we meet up with them, they're going to look different. And Thomas is on these antipsychotic drugs. And the people that I know who have gone through that have put on weight. They put on water weight with the medication. So Thomas, at the very least, is going to be heavier than Dominic. And so Mark agreed to do this process. And so we decided that the best way to do it was to have him as Dominic to lose weight. So he lost like 20 pounds to play Dominic. And, you know, he was on like a strict like 1,000 or like 1,100 calorie diet a day.
Sure.
And so he was, you know, the expression hangry.
Yeah.
He was hangry all the time. And that added to Dominic's angst, right? That added to this kind of alpha male, just uncomfortable quality that he had. And it was from day one, he was on with that, you know, so the physical thing changed his performance. And then one other thing I started to do with him on set was I started to ask him to do push-ups. Mark's a good guy, so he just goes along with it. But after, you know, I was doing like a phone call scene with him and Juliette Lewis, and it wasn't really happening. And so I just said, can you do 50 push-ups? So he dropped to the ground, did 50 push-ups. He came up, he did the scene, and it was actually the cut that made it in the movie. He was like a little out of breath, and he's smoking cigarettes, and his chest was kind of puffed out. And I thought it was so fascinating that it tuned him into this Dominic character who's kind of desperate for breath, and, you know, the traditional male with like the big pectoral muscles. And so that became our go-to for Dominic. Like anytime I needed to get Mark in the pocket with Dominic, I'd have him do push-ups. And there was times when he was doing 400 or 500 push-ups a day, because it was just like, you know, do another 50. And he questioned it at the beginning, but eventually, you know, if he wasn't getting a scene, he would be like, maybe I should do push-ups. And I was like, yeah, I should do it. And it was the instant way for him to get into Dominic. Now, at the end of those like 16 weeks that we shot with him as Dominic, he was ready to go off and be Thomas. And we had a lot of stuff to still shoot. You know, we had 6 weeks of shooting. We had to shoot the kids, we had to shoot the teenagers, and we had to shoot Grandpa's story. And so Mark went off and he was excited that he could go finally eat like a bowl of pasta or have a donut. But that lost its luster like after the second day. He became so miserable because his body just wasn't used to all this calories. You know, he went from eating 1,000 calories a day to like 4,500 calories a day. And, you know, he eventually got to the point where he was like, he could only sleep if he was sitting up in a chair. So he was calling me and basically saying, I don't know, D, if I can do this. Why don't I just put on like a fat suit or something to play Thomas? And I just encouraged him to stay with it. I said, look, as much as Dominic's weight loss and hangriness and, you know, push-ups added to that character, Thomas is going to feel a different way. And again, I'm interested in your behavior, not your performance as much. And sure enough, Mark showed up on set as Thomas and he was like over 30 pounds heavier. And he, you know, we had gotten the scene all set up and we were ready to shoot and he wouldn't come out of his trailer. And, you know, which is totally unlike Mark Ruffalo to do like a diva move like that. And so I went back to his trailer. You know, I've had to rescue plenty of actors from their trailer in my time, but never Mark. And I, you know, knocked on his door and he was the guy who I saw in that room couldn't have been further from Dominic. He was vulnerable. He was soft. He was scared out of his mind. He was insecure. He didn't have any confidence. He didn't know if he could do it. I spent about an hour with him. We watched The Devil and Daniel Johnston. I eventually brought him out to set and I'll never forget that moment walking with Mark on set as he like shuffled behind me and feeling the awe and the gasp from the crew as he arrived on set and no one knew who he was. Everyone on the crew thought Mark was Dominic because he's so method. He was like Dominic all the time. And now he shows up as this other guy, Thomas, and you know, no one could look at him. And he sat down in the seat and we were started to shoot the second side of the scene. And it was, and you know, before we started to shoot, it was actually on September 11th, 2019 that we shot the first day with Thomas. And he sat down in the scene and my assistant director said, let's do a prayer, you know, moment of silence for September 11th. And so we all did, there was a moment of silence. And after about a minute, we heard this voice, and it was Mark as Thomas saying a prayer for America. And it was just so poignant and kind of haunting, because here we were telling the story that took place in the early 90s about a guy who tried to end the wars in the Middle East by sacrificing his own, by sacrificing himself. And here we were 40 years later, still with the reverberation of everything that happened on September 11th, which was a reverberation of everything that happened in the 90s in the Middle East. And here we had this guy who all of a sudden wasn't the crazy character. He was the prophet to us. He was the truth. And so we all decided that Thomas wasn't the person we were going to look at as like a syndrome or a sickness, that he was just a man. And anyway, you know, that's kind of the alchemy that I'm really interested in as a filmmaker, is what happens when you start mixing these different elements together, what effect do they have? And I could go into a pitch meeting with HBO and tell them what the movie is going to be and they could buy it. But then I start this process and there's this alchemy that happens and something happens that none of us have expected, and it takes on its own life. And that's my favorite part about being a filmmaker, is to be a part of that alchemy.
Sure. The actor, I want to make sure I get the name right. I think his name's Philip Ettinger.
Yeah.
The one who plays the college student version of Dominic and Thomas. He did a phenomenal job as well.
Yeah, he's amazing, amazing actor. I felt like I was working with James Dean, reincarnate.
I was really blown away by his work. So I'm curious if you could talk about how you found him and just working with him to do those scenes.
Yeah, my good friend Braden King, filmmaker, had shot a movie called The Evening Hour with Phil. And I had never heard of Phil before. And then one day I was watching First Reformed, Paul Schrader, and Phil has this one scene in that movie, really. And it was the greatest performance I'd seen in a decade, you know, in that one scene. And I called up Braden and I was like, is that the guy you worked with? And Braden said, yeah. And I was like, dude, now I know why you picked him, because this guy's the greatest actor of all time. And so I set up to meet with him, and, you know, we met at a pie shop in Brooklyn. And Phil told me that Mark Ruffalo was always his favorite actor, and that he had met him backstage. And Mark was one of the reasons that Phil became an actor, and that people his whole life had always told him that he was kind of like Mark, like a young Mark Ruffalo. And Phil also, and he's talked about this, that's why I feel comfortable in talking about it, had an older brother that suffered with schizophrenia. And so he knew, he had this experience that he could really draw from. And again, part of what I do is in casting is try to cast actors that can be the experts, right, of their own experience, and that they can create these characters that are part them and part the character that I've written. And so there's a little bit of a documentary aspect to it. And so Phil and I talked a lot about his experience of being the brother of someone who was dealing with that, and also his observations of his brother. And, you know, his brother ultimately, like, we shot with him. He was like an extra in a scene. He was great, helpful guy the whole time. And he's doing pretty well right now. And so Phil just was brave enough to draw on his own personal experience with that character. And he was our first sighting of Thomas, Phil was, because Mark hadn't shot Thomas yet. We had shot all the 16 weeks with Mark as Dominic, and then Mark went away, and here comes Phil. And Phil had been studying what Mark had done as Dominic. I'd given him a bunch of dailies, and he'd been studying Mark's Dominic, but we still hadn't seen Thomas yet. And so Phil came out with a brand new Thomas that none of us knew how Thomas was going to be, but Phil showed us. Mark, as I was shooting Phil, I started sending Mark Phil's performance of Thomas, and Mark started studying what Phil did as Thomas to inform his version of Thomas. So it was such a beautiful collaboration that way. And everyone, all the actors were so respectful, and it was just a gift, you know, of each other. And anyway, yeah, Phil, he's a real treasure. Like I said, I really did feel like I was working with a modern James Dean.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that that your film or series does so well is the progression of watching Thomas, the progression of what happens to him. You know, it's not just this overnight thing. It's you can see the illness, you know, take hold, and you know what I mean. You watch the whole thing unfold, and that's one of the reasons it's, you know, again, why you can't accomplish this in a 2-hour movie, and why it's so effective as a series like this.
Yeah, for sure. And Phil knew that because he had experienced it himself. So he knew what that process could look like. And so thankful. Phil's a little taller than Mark. And so the only challenge on set was to give all the other actors 5-inch lifts. And so John Procaccino, who's like 6'4", was walking around set at 6'9". And But anyway, it's just
that's fun. That's a nice behind the scenes fact.
Yes. Yes.
So I have a few other questions I want to ask you about.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to a cotton candy autopsy?
Still working on it.
Okay. So it's yes. been almost a decade.
Yes. Longer than that. I mean, I first wanted to make cotton candy autopsy in 1991 when I first got the Mr. Bungle self-titled debut album. And the cover art on that album was from Cotton Candy Autopsy. And so I reached out to those guys not long after, and it's just, you know, that's just a giant, it's just one of those long, I'll make it before I die. And hopefully sooner rather than later. But I've written a script with my wife, Shannon, who's a clown. And, you know, we're really, you know, we talk about horror movies. But something else I really want to do is, like, I spend more of my time laughing than I do, like, being serious or in dramatic moments in my life. So I'm, and my wife's a comedian. And so we have been dying to do something funny. And, but this is, it's a story really about assimilation. And it's about these clowns who are trying to become normal and to assimilate back into normal society. But it's impossible. It's impossible if you're a clown.
Do you find this would be a movie, or do you think it's more of a series?
We'll see. I'm in, you know, I just literally finished I Know This Much Is True. So that is one of those things that's been a film forever in my mind. And I'm right now just open to what else it could be, you know, so we'll see.
What kind of life do you think Dane DeHaan went off and led at the end of Place Beyond the Pines?
That's another idea of this open ending that I tried to do at the end of I Know This Much Is True with Dominic and Dessa. What happens to them at the end of I Know This Much Is True? I have my ideas. What happens to Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams when they separate and walk off into their separate ways at the end of Blue Valentine? What happens to Dane at the end of Pines? I have my own ideas, but I don't want to say it because if I would have said it, I would have made it. And I want audiences to write their own endings. Again, this is what I try to think of as an audience member. I love having my own imagination in a movie. So there's not, it's almost like fan fiction at that point.
Sure. By the way, I think that, and you said it earlier in this interview, but the audience's imagination will always be more powerful than anything you put on screen.
I agree. It's mm-hmm. it's the shark in Jaws.
I was literally going to say that. It's like, it's always going to be more powerful. We talked a while ago, and I'm curious, whatever happened to Metalhead?
Metalhead became Sound of Metal, which is...
Yeah. Literally, I wanted to ask you that.
Yeah,
because I saw Sound of Metal at TIFF and was like, this is Metalhead.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I started making Metalhead from 2007, right when my son Cody was born. He's 13 now, until a couple months before I made Blue Valentine, and spent a year, 2 years shooting and editing Blue Valentine, came out of that, and I had Place Beyond the Pines ready to go. When I came out of Place Beyond the Pines, I went back to Metalhead, which I had been shooting with this band, Jucifer, almost like a hybrid doc. And I realized it wasn't, I wasn't going to be able to finish it the way that I had started it. I had just become such a different person, and I needed to, but I wanted it to get made still. I thought it was still a valuable story. And so my buddy Darius, I was looking for a film to make, and so I put it up for adoption. I put it up for adoption, and he raised it, and I'm so proud of him for what he has been able to do with it. And it's so nice to see a film that, you know, I mean, it's one of the great one of the things I love about where I'm at in my life right now is the ability to help other filmmakers get their visions out into the world. You know, I've been you know, there's, you know, Darius has his film. My wife has been making stuff that I've been helping her go with. There's other, you know, younger filmmakers that I've been, you know, trying to mentor. And, you know, I'd really like to not only, you know, because I'm so slow between my movies, you know,
the 4 years between every project.
Yeah. Basically. Something like that. So, you know, in those times though, I'd love, you know, and I just know what it takes for me to make something so I can help other people get stuff going. If I can have ideas, you know, I have a number of ideas, and if other people can take those ideas and run with them, then that's great. You know, as long as those ideas get to be realized, you know, because that was my biggest fear with Metalhead at one point. It's like, is this idea just going to turn into smoke? And so I'm thankful Darius adopted that kid and raised it well.
Yeah, I thought he did a really good job at showing what it was like for someone. You've seen it, obviously.
Mm.
Yeah. So I thought he did a really good job visualizing what someone was going through. And I thought Riz did a great job with his performance.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. You know what? One of the first inspirations for that movie was Nicholas Philibert did a documentary about a deaf world, a deaf community. Nicholas Philibert, who made To Be and To Have. And then I also think about all those movies I used to watch with Brackett, you know, Brackett movies like The Act of Seeing with One's Own Eyes and silent movies.
Sure.
And just the idea of playing with your senses in a movie was an idea of losing a sense. You know, in your life. And, you know, me, I'm a drummer, so I'm like halfway gone with my hearing. My tinnitus is so bad. So it's, yeah, anyway.
No, I don't want to say too much more about it. Yeah. Eventually people are going to see it, but, have, Gosling and Eva Mendes ever thanked you for introducing them?
Oh, I don't know about that. I've thanked them a bunch for sure.
By the way, I'm just fucking with you, but you
being
know
two I mean. Of the most beautiful people I know, and you know, it was amazing shooting that movie and seeing them together. You know, it was like really, really beautiful, beautiful experience, and I'm so happy for them. You know, hopefully work with both of them again someday soon.
Yeah, I would say that you and Ryan together have been okay.
Yes.
It's been all right. When are people going to be able to watch on streaming or see Brother Tide?
I don't know. I don't know. That's kind of a scary proposition. That's like the juvenilia, you know. Maybe I have to be a little older for that to happen. Or someone has to come out and decide that they want to option all those 1950s doo-wop Christmas songs that I put in the soundtrack.
Well, my question for you is, so you have, who owns the rights? Do you own the rights to the film?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So basically it's a question of, because of the soundtrack, of ponying up in cash.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, I have the 35mm print in my dad's basement in Colorado.
So it's, yeah. So it's just a question of...
There.
Yeah. I mean, because there's fans of yours that have obviously never seen the movie. And there's not much footage that is out there. So, I'm just curious.
I know. We'll see. I'm open. If someone ever came out of the woodwork who wanted to release that, I'd love to have a conversation with them. I'd love for, you know, people to see it. It would be hard for me to watch it just because it represents a different era of, I mean, similar subject matter, but a different way in which I was making films at that time in my life. You know, that was, I think, still when I was more egocentric as a filmmaker. It was more about me at that time. You know, that was when I was in film school and when I thought that I was going to make the, you know, I'd heard the Wild Bunch had 1600 edits and I thought that I could make a movie with more edits than the Wild Bunch. I mean, that was like why I made that movie in a lot of ways, was to cut more than the Wild Bunch. And I remember showing it at Sundance in 1998 and seeing that there was like six people in the audience. And I realized six people can't give a shit about my edits. And I started to realize that why did I love movies from the first place? And it was actors. And so in all those years between Brother Tide and Blue Valentine, I learned to, I learned what was always important to me about being a filmmaker. So yeah, it would be interesting. Be interesting if someone wants to release it. Yeah, it'd be awesome, I guess.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. There's something. If I remember correctly, there was a shot in through like a like a party scene where like the camera's on a dolly going through the party. I could be wrong about this.
Yes, there was.
Right. Okay. So I'm not mistaken on this. But I remember that shot being like, oh fuck, that is a cool shot.
Yeah, you know? There was a lot of shots. We were doing like 70 setups a day on that. I was the DP. We had dolly tracks all over the place. We had like a little, you know, 12-person crew of all of our friends at the film school. And we were just living it, making a family, making a movie. And it was, you know, it took like 4.5 years to put it together. And yeah, it represents a certain time. I think I would probably be ready with people seeing it if someone wanted to pony up.
I'm just throwing this out there because we have a lot of people that work at Collider, and I ask people for questions. And something that people wanted to know was HBO is getting ready to do, you know, their series or their limited series of Parasite. And so the question is, of course, if they asked you to do an episode, would you be willing?
All depends on availability and time and what I'm doing. You know, I mean, I obviously signed this deal with HBO, so I love working with them. And I have my own projects I'm going to be, bringing to them, and we'll see what happens with those. Yeah, I never say never. It's the difficult thing about jumping into a show that's already like a perfect movie. You know, like I don't know what necessarily I would add to it. I always feel strange about making other people's movies because I feel like every filmmaker, they make their own choices, and I love to see the choices they make, and I couldn't make their same choices, but I wouldn't want to change any filmmaker's choice that they ever make either. You know,
no, I get it. I do. Yeah. I think that Bong has talked about how there was a lot of stuff that he wrote that obviously didn't make the movie. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, he's very supportive of doing this series.
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
You know, but what, this is basically my last thing for you because we've talked for 17 hours. But I am curious, do you have a lot of scripts in the desk that you want to make? Do you have things that are sort of ready to go? Or do you sort of, and also like, obviously you signed the deal with HBO, you can do stuff, but like you just worked your ass off for the last few years. Is it sort of like, I need months to like decompress?
Even the things that I have in my desk. And yeah, I do have a number of scripts. I have Cotton Candy. I have Empire of the Summer Moon. I have Muscle. I have a lot. I have other original projects that I've been working on. But even if I was to do one of those projects that the script is already written and I've already, you know, Empire of the Summer Moon written 30 drafts on it, I have to start over again because I'm a different person now than I was before I started, I Know This Much Is True. And when I go into it again new, it's going to change. And I have to kind of start all over again. So, but at the same time, I'm in the place now where I need to, you know, I make movies about family. And so I've been trying to just be with my family. And, you know, I can't be hypocritical if I'm make movies about family. My inspiration comes from being a father and a son. And so, to use the metaphor, like I feel like the well is pretty dry. And so I need it to rain.
A lot of people watching this I think they don't realize the amount of time it takes to actually make a project, what it takes to film, what it takes to edit, and what sacrifices you have to make in your personal life to actually accomplish putting something like this on the screen.
Yeah. I mean, it's full on. It's my, up until 2 weeks ago, it was 7 days a week, 12 hours a day for 12 hours a day minimum for the last 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And it was a blessing every moment. Every moment I felt like I was on vacation. So now that I'm done with it, now I have to go back to work and I have to figure out what I'm going to do again. Right now the work starts. And it's a lot and it's relentless, but it's a blessing because this is like my dream since I can remember dreaming, was that I would make movies or, you know, tell stories, on film, you know, TV shows, whatever. And so I take every moment and every chance I get and every opportunity I get, I take it as a real blessing and a joy.
Yeah. Look, I'm super happy you made something with HBO or some deal because, you know, I want you making more projects and yeah. Obviously you are, what we call a talented filmmaker. So
don't rush me, Steve.
Say it again.
Don't rush me.
Right. Well, hopefully it will be faster than 4 years, but I also yes. understand that, you got to spend time with your family and stuff. You know yeah. what I mean? Like,
I mean, my oldest son's 16 years old. So that happens quick, man.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about, but I get what you're saying. Yes. On that note, I'm just going to say thank you so much for talking with me for 17 hours. And yes. Please pass on to your family that I said thank you.
Yes.
For real.
I'm going to go get the chicken off the grill now.
Right, exactly. And listen, man, again, congrats on the series.
Man, good to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you in cyberspace.
Yes. All right, next time, face-to-face, okay, when the world comes back to something.
It's that little Chico Pitbull, Mr. 305, better said Mr. Worldwide, and I'm here to tell you about my new podcast, From Negative to Positive, brought to you by my friends over at State Farm. I believe that to have success, you got to play the game so that the game doesn't play you. You know, the biggest risk you take is not taking one. It's very important that you make sure that you make the most out of your money, especially when it comes to insurance. State Farm offers surprisingly great rates. They have great agents standing by helping you personalize your coverage. All this is backed up by award-winning, easy-to-use technology. It's a great price with an even greater service. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Does anybody want breakfast? Guys, let's go. I'm leaving for McDonald's in 5 seconds.
Why did you start with that?
The Breakfast Stampede Meal. It's only at McDonald's, where there's a meal for every morning.
And nothing says morning like a classic sausage McMuffin with egg. Right now, get this all-time favorite for just $2 on the $1-$3 menu. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.